media has become one of the many arenas in which debates about inclusivity and justice have taken center stage in recent months. And now into this troubled world comes Taste the Nation. Hosted by Top Chef's Padma Lakshmi, the marvelous Hulu series visits immigrant and indigenous communities around the United States to explore food.
Taste the Nation puts everything from chop suey to pad thai in cultural, political, and culinary contexts with Lakshmi as your hungry, curious guide. I'm Glenn Weldon.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking about Taste the Nation on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Here with me and Glenn, always a joy from her home in Maryland, is our pal, the writer Kat Chow. Hey, Kat.
Hey, greetings from my closet and all the clothes that I will never wear.
It's always good to have you from anywhere, but especially a closet full of clothes.
Yep.
So I'm going to start with Glenn a little bit. What is your response to Taste the Nation?
Well, as a showcase for Lakshmi, you know, it's her concept. She's a producer. She hosts. It's great. I mean, what you might not know about her is how weirdly plugged in she is to the comedy scene, to the New York comedy scene specifically.
Oh.
So it's not just chefs that she's interviewing here. It's comedians like Ali Wong and Maz Jobrani. You get a sense of her sense of humor here. She's smart. She's quick. She listens in a way that doesn't seem like she's waiting for the other person to shut up so she can say her next thing. But she also leaves things into the show, weird things like closing a car door on her jacket and absolutely hacking up a fish in an attempt to make poke, stuff that other hosts would leave out. Like, imagine for a second Heidi Klum putting herself out there in an unguarded way. And as a food show, it also really worked for me because the danger of a show like this is once you say, hey, you know what food is? Really? It's culture. It's history. It's coming together, which are all true, but they're not really revelations. And if you don't go further, your show is just some more pretty food shots. This show says all of those things, but it always is committed to digging deeper. It pokes at some pretty unpleasant truths that you wouldn't expect in a food show, and it makes connections. And when it makes those connections, it answers questions that have been hovering kind of in the ether for years. Like, my favorite episode is the Thai food episode.
Yes.
Because I had no idea why, when I was growing up, Thai food was not around. And then suddenly, in the 1990s, it was everywhere. I didn't know why that happened. I didn't know the role that Thai women played in that transformation or where those women came from. So I'm all in.
Yeah. And just for people who haven't yet watched it, you know, Glenn mentioned the Thai food episode. There are a number of different episodes. Some of them feel more like food that Americans are often less familiar with. Like, she talks about Persian food as something that fewer people might know so far,
mm-hmm.
versus something like Thai food versus something like Chinese American food. Because my personal favorite episode is the chop suey episode, mm-hmm. where she talks about the idea of Chinese American food and kind of where it shifts over to where it's its own American food, so that the questions about authenticity that are referencing food in China become not the right way to think about certain kinds of food. Mm-hmm. Kat, tell me how this show struck you.
I really liked how Padma, for the most part, let these people, mostly women, cook their own food. And yet the show didn't rely too much on how to make food. I mean, for the most part, we had these beautiful scenes that showed the ingredients. But she let the stories about the food and the people who made them really take the stage. There was a woman who she interviewed in her episode about Peruvian food. The woman's name was Rosa Carhuayanqui. And Rosa says something to the effect of, people know about the restaurants of Peruvian food, but not necessarily about the home cooks. And I think that really sums up Padma's ethos with the show and what she's trying to do, which is really explore the mostly women as carriers of culture, as she puts it in a later episode. I just found that really profound and powerful. And there was something about Padma's orientation as an immigrant herself, which, you know, she underscores this so clearly in the intro of every single episode. She talks about this frequently, that made her, as Glenn said, a really great listener. And there was just a general empathy, but also an understanding. Tejal Rao, who is a writer at the New York Times, wrote a piece about this show, and she said that there was something about Padma almost being like a guest in these homes, which I think is a really great way to sum up the feel of the show, where she felt like she was being invited into the kitchens of these people who really created the cuisines in this country. And I think that was a really powerful testament to the people who made this food and the circumstances in which they came to the States.
One of the things I really love about it is that clearly Padma is very like conscious of the political climate into mm-hmm. which this show is coming out. So there are references to the hostility toward immigration, not just in general, but I think, again, the Persian food episode, she goes back very specifically and kind of reviews how the cultural hostility that a lot of Americans have displayed toward people who immigrated from Iran, like how that developed in the 1980s, how it kind of continued and changed the prospects even for something like Persian food.
Right.
And I think she does a very good job, the show does a very good job of kind of placing those things in context. And the thing I admire about the show so much is that every one of these episodes seems to me to have a point that is not just, let's talk about what kind of food XYZ immigrant community or indigenous community specializes in or what have you. There are additional, this is I think kind of what Glenn was saying about going deeper. For example, in the episode that she does with a group of Native Americans where they talk about food on reservations, mm-hmm. there is this discussion about fry bread and about the idea that fry bread is the food of indigenous people in the United States and how that is largely a misunderstanding that is based on. She talks about kind of how commodity food came to reservations,
right, yeah.
and how that's kind of where the idea of fry bread, which doesn't make it not something that people really eat, but it's a very colonial kind of food, not a natural outpouring of what the ingredients were that people were using prior to colonization and prior to genocide and the advent of reservations.
Yeah.
Right. I totally could have watched two more episodes on the idea of food sovereignty, and just the way that episode wove together the history of it really was very thoughtful.
Yeah, that was to me the most eye-opening episode, and it arrives situated in the season in a very smart place, because in this age of binging, you structure your series in a specific way. And I know precious little about indigenous food, but the connections that that episode makes, delving into the history of indigenous genocide, is setting you up for a later episode, the final episode of the season, which is about poke, mm-hmm. which is about how fluidly Japanese and Hawaiian cultures and then cuisines came together. It's there for a reason, so that episode hangs in the back of your mind as you're watching this other episode about a much more successful blend.
I mean, really what we are learning about in this show is American history. And I think that the way that the show demonstrates how this history builds upon itself and you see echoes of certain policies of discrimination throughout, it was really smartly done. It wasn't perfect, but I think that for a lot of people, this show is eye-opening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's talk about not perfect, Kat. What would you have changed about it?
Oh, Glenn, it sounds like you liked this, but I really thought the interludes with the comedians and her famous celeb friends were not exactly necessary. I enjoyed them, but I thought that the tight narratives about the people who make the food really spoke for themselves. I did enjoy, you know, the appearance of Preet Bharara. I really loved Madar Jaffe in the Dosa episode where she cooks with her. Madar Jaffe is the famous actress and cookbook writer. But there were some points where I was thinking, I could just see this episode doing really well with sticking with just the interviews and sort of the beautiful profiles of the people who really pioneered the cuisines.
Well, I see what you're saying. And I do love that Madar Jaffe episode, the episode that Madar Jaffe is featured in, because I own a dog-eared, beaten-up, turmeric-stained Madar Jaffe cookbook. It's my favorite cuisine. And to see her on that show being as warm and as wise as her writing is was a revelation. That said, there's a lot of shows doing that out there. And the reason I like the comedians so much is because they added some acid. Look what I did just there. Wasn't planned. But they're adding something that isn't in a lot of these shows. There's a tendency for these shows to be very reverent and a little precious. And Ali Wong is there to cut through the fat.
I could see that.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, I think Kat mentioned earlier how much it is a show about women, and I very much appreciated what I think is a really conscious treatment of gender from Padma, who is a woman who has such an interesting set of experiences in that regard, right? Yes. And one of the things I so appreciated about this, and I kept looking at it and trying to figure out the right way to describe it, the way she eats is so hungry. The way she eats is not precious. She takes big bites of things and talks about how good it is. And there's a wonderful moment in that episode with the indigenous decolonialized Thanksgiving, as they called
yes,
it,
yes,
where they talk about the fact that if there weren't cameras here, we would be eating with our hands. Mm-hmm. And so
yeah, I totally get that.
And a discussion about like, then let's do that. Because she really wants to break down the idea that I think is both gendered and raced and just televisioned, that food is to be kind of poked at and admired. She likes to eat food. And I think particularly for beautiful women, sometimes you don't see beautiful women on television who embrace how much they love to eat food.
Mm-hmm. Right. There was kind of this way that she showed the physicalness of eating and cooking, where a few times, I think, she talks about how she cooks with her hands and the shots of her just digging her hands into, you know, the stuff to make tamales. And it's just so in your face in a way that is actually very real.
And you notice it, especially now, because, I mean, this was all made before the world blew up. This show will make you feel, be prepared. It's going to make you feel nostalgic for restaurants, for crowded food markets, for popping food into your mouth without a care in the damn world, which is a thing I might never do again, and for sharing food huddled over that food with large groups of people. It is a relic of a time. It's also a great show, but it's also a relic of a very particular age.
Yeah, boy, it really made me miss restaurants. And I have to say, the other one that I do want to talk about, too, is that Chop Suey episode, because I think there's such a smart way that they approach that moment when the point of reference changes. And it's partly because Chinese American food has been around for centuries now,
right,
where the point of reference changes to where you don't say, well, this is not authentic to Chinese food in China. Kat, how did that episode strike you?
You know, I sort of struggled with that episode at first because I felt that the overarching question that Padma went in with it was, what is chop suey? What is chop suey? What is chop suey? And she asked it so many times that it became really distracting for me because I wanted to just say, why does this have to be how you investigate the idea of Chinese American food? But I think that for sort of a structural sense in that episode, it was really smart because it's a way to, you know, as we were talking about before, look at how Chinese exclusion shaped the ability to have access to certain foods. And, you know, there's even a moment where they go to an Asian American farmer in the Bay Area and they talk about how to grow certain foods and what this means for communities and sort of how food really can be political in the aspect of how you farm it too. So, I mean, while the threading of that episode, what is chop suey, didn't really work for me personally, I think how the episode explored all of these different facets of Chinese American culture and Chinese American cuisine, it did wind up being effective and provocative in some senses.
Yeah, that's interesting. I had similar qualms about the hot dog episode, which, of course, is the staple food of my people. And I'm biased here because I find hot dogs gross. You know, what is it about them? I don't know. Maybe it's the flavor. Maybe it's the color. Maybe it's the smell. Maybe it's the consistency. Maybe it's all those things. I just don't care about them. I find them disgusting. And I fast forwarded through that episode so fast because, like, this is not an interesting niche food stuff. This is omnipresent. So, and we have precious little time. There's only 10 episodes. Why are you wasting time on this?
I think I know why this was included, and I definitely know one reason I was glad it was included, and that is to make the point that white European immigrant food is also mm-hmm. immigrant food.
Yeah.
And I think what they didn't want to do is say, first you have the food eaten and brought to the United States by white people, including white Europeans, then you have the food brought to the United States by immigrants. I think it was to try to include in your idea of immigrant communities, in that case, German-American, Milwaukee, Wisconsinites, who have, you know, also a specific cultural idea of what their kind of food traditions are, and to avoid kind of a default white European person surrounded by quote-unquote immigrant communities. I agree with you that it was in some ways the least inspirational episode for me personally.
Yeah.
But I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
The last thing that I want to talk about very quickly before we go is how you think this fits into the kind of the traditional of food travel shows. Because to me, it was impossible to watch this and not think about Anthony Bourdain, who is so well known for being kind of curious and out in the world and welcoming of new experiences with food he didn't know well. But her energy is really different than Bourdain's, I think, because he still, although he was kind of a questioner of that kind of macho kitchen culture, he was also very much of that macho kitchen culture. What do you think, Kat? Do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah. I mean, I think it was really hard for me to watch this without thinking about the broader discussions of race and quote unquote objectivity in media and even in the food world, where perspectives are so much a big part of, you know, who the host is, who the reporter is, who the writer is, that you can't disentangle that. And I think that this show felt like a complete demonstration of that, where it's just subtle things. You know, Padma uses her hands to cook, as we discussed, just the way she talks to these women, especially in the Thai episode, where they completely rib her, you know, just the ways that she's just made to eat food constantly by these aunties. Her orientation is just a big part of the show. And it is what it is. There's no questioning it. And I thought that as a premise itself, where every single episode you're reminded that she is an immigrant who came to this country. It shows a photo of her when she's young. We don't see that in other travel shows. And there's a real, for the most part, respect of the carriers of the culture. And not to say that, you know, Anthony Bourdain did not do that, but I think just her perspective itself makes it different.
Yeah, I agree. Again, Taste the Nation is on Hulu. There are 10 episodes. I think we all enjoyed it a lot. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. Tell us what you thought. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So come right back.
Whenever you face a choice, it helps to think like an economist. And this week on Planet Money Summer School, we'll start off our course in economics with a workout for your brain, how to decide what something truly costs. Listen now to Planet Money from NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
End of the Century is an Argentinian film that came out last year. It's about a hot Argentinian guy living in Berlin who goes to Barcelona and hooks up with a hot guy there. They then realize that they had hooked up before 20 years prior in 1999, but both of them were closeted at the time, so nothing happened. Then they take a walk around Barcelona, and they're talking, and they're going to museums, and they're eating, and they're drinking. And the film keeps adding layers and shifts in time and perspective. It's been called The Spanish Weekend, that 2011 British film. But that limits it, I think. It's really an accomplished debut feature written and directed by this guy, Lucio Castro. And, you know, if you're in the market for some pangs lately, if you're feeling a little pang deprived, whether it's for travel or a museum or bars or restaurants or hooking up when you're young and hot, this will occasion in you a kind of an affectionate ache, a longing, a pang. It's a beautiful film. That's End of the Century, rentable on iTunes.
Oh, thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. That sounds like something I would enjoy. Kat Chow, I love it when you bring us happies remotely, but now you are here talking to me. Tell me what's making you happy this week.
Well, what's making me happy this week is this novel called Breasts and Eggs by Mieko Kawakami. And she's a Japanese writer, and this novel was translated recently in English. And it's a multi-part story that focuses on the lives of these three women, a writer named Natsu, her older sister Makiko, and Makiko's young daughter Midoriko. And the book is so much about the body. If you are craving a novel that really describes a woman's body so well, just in terms of desire, in terms of longing, in terms of just a sense of self, then this is a fantastic novel to read. And I highly recommend it. That's Breasts and Eggs by Mieko Kawakami.
Oh, thank you very much, Kat. So What is Making Me Happy This Week is a documentary that you can watch on Netflix. It is out this week and it is called Mucho, Mucho Amor. It is about the Spanish language astrologer Walter Mercado, whose audience on TV and radio, they cite with numbers like 120 million, 200 million, particularly in the 70s, 80s, 90s, all the way up through about 2006. He had different kind of television appearances. He was on Primer Impacto for a really long time on Univision. He actually passed away in 2019. And this was a documentary that was made quite late in his life. There's a wonderful quote from an actor who says the first time he ever saw Walter Mercado, he wasn't sure if he was looking at a woman, a man, or a sorcerer. It was capes, it was jewels, it was makeup. He doesn't talk about his sexuality, but he's got a very, like, I am sexually into the universe. And it's he's just such an interesting dude. And what I love about this documentary is that he is somebody who, depending on how you're situated in the world, is either one of the most famous people you can think of, right? Or potentially somebody who you don't know a lot about. And I think the documentary is sort of effective at bridging that and really both profiling him for people to whom he's a very important figure and also introducing him to people who know him a little bit less via things like a meeting that they show between him and Lin-Manuel Miranda, who brings his dad to come visit him in Puerto Rico when they were in Puerto Rico doing Hamilton. And if you think about how many extremely famous people Lin-Manuel Miranda had met by January 2019, and then you watch how utterly undone he is by meeting this guy and how utterly in tears, overwhelmed with nostalgia, it is a really, really fun, but also very, very touching and interesting film about how this guy was so successful at a time when it was like, you couldn't come out, but you could be... There's a saying that they quote that says, what you can see, you don't ask about. It's a lot of fun. Very much recommend it. Mucho, mucho amor. The Legend of Walter Mercado is streaming on Netflix. Good stuff. Good stuff. And that is what is making me happy this week. That brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Glenn at G.H. Weldon and Kat at Kat Chow. You can find our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the music that I just know you are bobbing your head to right now, wherever you are. Thanks to both of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. If you have a second, subscribe to our newsletter. It is over at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. We will see you all next week when we will be talking about... You've waited for it. It's coming at last. Floor is Lava.